Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Other Minds and Hands. This is episode number 71. Maggie and I are back after a little bit of a break, in which I was over in UK time. And of course, I've noticed, Maggie, how I automatically said good evening because it still feels like evening to me because I just flew over yesterday.
I was going to say, I'm like, when did you get home? Like, you're still in my
home. Last night about midnight, and it's still like, still kind of on. I've been up long enough for it to feel like evening already. So
welcome to my normal Monday night exhaustion levels, Corey.
That's it. We'll get sleepy at the same time tonight. But anyway,
sorry, we're a bit late. We had a lot to catch up on. So.
Yes, we did.
But we're here and ready to talk Return of the King again.
We are. We're going to go back to the cracks of doom. And actually, before we get lodged into that, let's look ahead a little bit into what, especially what's coming next week, because next week we're going to have a guest, and I'm really excited about this. This is going to be a fun opportunity to talk about adaptation from a quite different angle. And this is going to be a lot of fun. Our guest next week is going to be Jordan Rennells. Jordan Rennells is the audio engineer who has been producing what he calls a long-expected soundscape. Many of you will be familiar with Jordan Rennells from Prancing Pony podcast fame. He's the audio editor of the Prancing Pony podcast. Many of you in that community will know of him there. And what Jordan does is this, he's done this not only for Tolkien's work, but for others. Did you know that he's done a whole Harry Potter soundscape as well, Maggie?
Yep, I have often studied to that.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. So basically what he does is he engineers a whole, like, many layered audio track to sync with the audiobook, the unabridged audiobook recordings. And I've been listening through his Lord of the Rings soundtrack with the Rob Inglis recordings, and he's synced them to both Rob Inglis and Andy Serkis, actually. It's a remarkable experience. Really looking forward to speaking with him about that. Of course, this really starts to connect to one of the elements of adaptation we've touched on, but like we've touched on soundtracks and music before, like in our conversations with Bear McCreary and, some of the other conversations like that that we've had. But this is not something that is really like in the central expertise of either one of us. And so we've not spent that much time talking about it. And this is such a fascinating project to be doing direct, really sort of direct adaptation of the audiobook itself in this way and transforming an audiobook listening experience into this, sort of fully adapted audio environment is really fascinating.
Well, and to create that experience, it feels like one of the least adapted platforms for people to engage with because there's not like a major distribution for something like this or, a massive audience call for this specific thing, but that's why it's kind of so unique. Like the only time I can think that we've mentioned it was when I was talking about the BBC adaptation last year of Susan Cooper's Dark is Rising, because they recorded that with like 3D sound effects and suggested you listen to it with headphones and you could hear the hooves stamping and the snow falling and all these things as they went through it. And it really does change your entire engagement with the story. So not just walking around your kitchen and doing dishes or cleaning up and listening to an audiobook, you are living that environment. Like the way it kind of brings you in, it's just so much easier to lift that veil of unbelievability, right? Like to suspend that belief and engage more fully with the text that, it's really quite magical. So I think that's going to be a really neat thing to talk about because we don't get to talk about it that often in terms of adaptation practice.
Exactly. So thinking about audio and what audio adaptation is about and what audio, how audio mixing contributes to, just that as a medium for adaptation, I think is going to be a really, really fun discussion. So that's going to be
creation.
Next week.
Yeah, just creation too, like tone. This scene feels like this. How did you go about creating that? How do you make a feeling through sound effects?
Yeah.
Excuse me. I think it's going to be really fun.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So that's next week. We'll remind people again at the end, but I wanted to mention it at the beginning.
It's a different time, right? Or is it the same? I can't remember.
Same time, I
Same
believe.
time? Okay. I'm in your time zone. That's why it's different. I'm on the East Coast.
That's right. It's different for you, same for
Different for
us.
me.
Yeah.
Yes. 4:30. Got it.
Yep. Should be good.
Awesome.
Should be good. Yeah, cool. So excellent. Anyway, so as I say, just wanted to mention that here at the beginning to make sure I didn't, overlook it. And then we'll mention it again at the end to remind folks who join us late. But all right. Let's get back into the cracks of Doom. So last time this is our first instance of this new, well, I got series is a little bit loose, but this is we did the thing where we were comparing and contrasting openings, right? Again, as a way to introduce the close reading in comparison. One of the things I think that's challenging is trying to kind of build the vocabulary. Like, how do you talk about how film does things versus how things happen in books? It's the kind of thing that people kind of pay lip service to, like understanding that visual storytelling and, print storytelling are different in our different modes, but what's different about them? How are they different? What are the strengths and weaknesses of each? How do they approach doing these things? What kind of patterns do we see in those things? So our openings series, where we talked about a whole bunch of opening stuff, was our first sort of approach at kind of trying to build this vocabulary, trying to understand more clearly how this works. This second series, after the opening series, this is a what, let's call it the analogs series, like the two
Okay.
analogous scenes, right, where we're looking at, and the goal here is not to be focusing on differences, right? That's, of course, the place where we almost always go. Like, one's mind almost always goes to, like, where do they
It's the
make
very
different
natural
choices?
comparison. Yeah.
Yes. But instead, what we're doing is we're looking at moments where the film and the book are doing very, very similar things, where they're telling almost the same story in their own different modes, right? As a way to see more clearly. So what we're comparing and contrasting is not just the storytelling, like the choices that they make. I've deliberately tried to choose scenes that are as little different as is possible. Though, we talked about this last time, but when you really get down to it, that's super hard to do, actually. Because even in the middle of this one, we'll talk today about a part of this scene, which is pretty significantly different. From the way that the thing is told in the book. Anyway, so again, the point is, when both things are basically describing the same scene, when the same thing is as close as possible, when the same thing is happening in each scene, what do we see about how do we what can we notice about how the book approaches telling that story, that part of that story, right? The story of that scene versus how the film tells that story of that scene. Anyway, so that's what I'm thinking. So actually, so Alan W. just made a suggestion. Entry into Meduseld and Edoras by Aragorn and Legolas and Gimli and Gandalf. See, but here's the thing, Alan. I thought of that. But I'm like, but no, it's too different, right? Think about like the fight scenes that are happening, right? Remember when like the supporters of Wormtongue are attacking them, and Gimli and Legolas and Aragorn are like beating people up all the way down the aisle? That's a pretty significant difference from what we see in the text. Again, I'm not saying that it's like a bad idea or wrong or anything. But it does make that story, and then you've got the whole Saruman possession thing that they do with Théoden, and the exorcism, like the exorcism of Saruman by Gandalf, which it's based on a little bit on things that are happening in the book. But again, that's quite different from how that's handled. So even though, again, I see there's a whole, like, there are ways in which that is similar, but it's
It's
different.
genuinely like really difficult to come up with scenes that do this because There's so much abridging that has to happen in adaptation anyway. Like things are gonna get sliced and condensed wherever possible. So it's actually pretty tough to find a section that in words on a page does kind of the similar thing. But no matter how close you try to stay to it, it's going to be interpreted differently. So I think that's what's interesting about this exercise we're embarking on, of just look, it is faithful and there's no betrayal and all these big words that we keep throwing around. And yet there's still a lot for us to talk about.
Yeah, it's inevitably different. And so just, in the the title of the episode, which is the same as we did last time, translation and interpretation, right? And the comparison, I was making this comparison last time. It's like translating something into a different language, right? It's not about like, oh, but were you faithful enough? Did you make, too many changes? It cannot be the same. When you translate from one language to another, the thing cannot be the same, no matter how faithful you are trying to be. And that's what we're trying to understand, right? We're trying to understand what happens. It's like what happens when you translate something from English into German, right? Some things inescapably happen when you do that.
And
And yeah.
I don't think I know enough about this for us to talk about it at length, but it might be something fun for us to kind of explore as reception theory and like, the whole way that we as a group kind of absorb information and through textual absorption, there's one way of kind of receiving that and how creators give us that information and how they describe things and the language that they use. Is it more visual or is it more practical? There's some real techniques just in textual imparting of information for analysis. Visual analysis and audience reception for visual mediums, there's just a lot more elements to consider. So the reception side of it, where in text, I don't know, maybe three or four main prongs of reception, I would say there's probably 20 to 30 for visual analysis prongs of reception. Because some people are going to be way more tuned into the music. Some people are going to be way more tuned into actor performance. Like, there's just so many different ways that you can receive that story. There's a lot of that awareness you hope goes into the production, that they're aware that people are going to receive this information differently. So they spend a lot of time thinking about each different element. And sometimes you see that in filmmaking, and other times it falls completely flat. And that might be why, because they didn't give any thought to soundtrack or soundscape or, whatever. Yeah. So that's kind of the fun thing for us to play around with this. It's not just taking text to screen. It's perception, description, all these other things that kind of form our experience with this story. And textual and visual are just so different. It really can't be a comparison most of the time. And yet here we are in every website ever doing all those YouTube videos, what's different, book to film? Like, of course, that's our natural inclination, but it's near impossible to actually do that.
Exactly. But you can come to an understanding of it, just as you can begin to see. Like, the fun thing is that if you do a careful comparison of like an English original and, a German translation, as I said, not only will it will can you like come to understand and appreciate what they were doing in doing that translation, it will also actually help you to understand things about the English and German languages that you didn't understand before. And that's fun, right? That's really cool. But I mentioned German, by the way, because I was having just been at UK Moot over this past weekend, our first Europe Moot in a long time. And there were people there from lots of different European countries. And so we were talking and thinking about our next European Moot, which is in Stuttgart in Germany in October. And the so and I was joking with him. I'm like, well, so in preparation for traveling to Germany, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get a German translation of The Lord of the Rings and use that to teach myself German. Because I figure that'll be
you
the
know
best way to
Lord
do
of
it.
the Rings,
It's true that like my vocabulary might be a little idiosyncratic, but it'll be the easiest way for me to pick it up because I already know the original text so
that's
well. You
great.
know, I'll just it'll be great. That's my plan. But
Yeah, one of the first books I bought in Welsh was the Harry Potter because
yeah.
of the same thing. But man, there's a lot of made up words in that book, so it proved really difficult.
Yep.
That's great.
It is. Anyway, yeah, I figure nothing can go wrong with my language plan.
Works for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Cracks of Doom, eh?
Cracks of Doom. So here we go. Back to the Cracks of Doom. So last time we spent a lot of time, we started with the text and we spent a lot of time looking at the text and we were looking at things like how the point of view of the text, how Sam's point of view is sort of asserted both explicitly and implicitly at different points, and the way in which the narrator kind of intervenes and kind of shifts the scene from like a larger point of view down to Sam's point of view, and how that happens. Anyways, that was one thing we were looking at. We were looking at even like the structure of the sentences. Some of my favorite sentences in The Lord of the Rings in this description, those long architectonic sentences from all his policies and webs of fear and treachery, from all his stratagems and wars, his mind shook free, right? All that sentence, for instance. Anyway, so and we got through Gollum's taking the ring and falling into the fire, and then the brief vision of the destruction of the Dark Tower, Barad-dûr, and how that all is described. Then we started looking at the film. We talked about this some, but we didn't nearly finish talking about this stuff. So let's think in terms. Where we what we kind of did, we got as far as like looking at several touch points in the film and how what they're focused like how they're but I want to kind of come in at the film and think more about the like the overall flow of storytelling and how so you know Maggie, you chose a few shots that you thought were sort of suggestive about how the story unfolds there. So let's just kind of review some of the shots that you were looking at, and then we can kind of see, kind of walk through a little bit how, like, what is the kind of the trend of the story and how what they're sort of emphasizing. So we're sort of starting the sequence with Frodo standing holding the ring, and we talked about the internal callbacks there and the way that this is sort of the culmination of a thing that's been building along, the parallel between Frodo holding the ring up like this and Boromir holding the ring up like that before, right?
With so many of these, I mean, I wish I could have had a storyboard for this, you know, like if we had an actual access to the film storyboard, because that I think is such a great exercise in storytelling, and a really good way to instruct this too. So like whenever I've taught stuff like this, storyboarding is where we start, because you'll read a paragraph, you know, like when we were doing Concerning Hobbits, and you'll read a bit about, you know, that meeting in Bilbo's house and have 20 people storyboard that very short scene, and every single person's storyboard will be completely different of how they frame that. So it's a really good example and like a really good way to be like, see, everybody sees this differently. So it's really helpful to have a storyboard from a creator like Peter Jackson to be able to say, see, this is what they were trying to visualize. But it also is just a really good clear way to take a line of text and throw it onto a visual and have a starting point. So if you can scroll really quickly through those, what is it, five or six slides of just pictures, not like crazy fast, but like scroll through them so it's as if we're looking through.
So we start with Frodo holding the ring, with the glow of the fires behind him and the smoke and everything, right? Then we
Just
have,
yeah.
okay,
Yeah.
then we're looking down at him holding the ring over the lava, right, standing on the edge. And there's, and we look back at Sam. And of course, the scene behind Sam, this is the one that we remember most clearly from the Elrond Isildur flashback earlier on, right? That's the shot of Frodo from above wouldn't necessarily look familiar, but the shot looking back at Sam reminds us of the, like, we were here before, right? Now Sam is in the Elrond position and Frodo is in the Isildur position much more explicitly, right?
You're taking my lines here, Corey.
Sorry.
I'm like, just scroll through the video.
Just scroll through. Okay, all right, here we go. Sorry. There's Sam, there's Frodo, and there's Sam. Okay, all right, there we go. And then we get, then Sam gets knocked over and we get Gollum pouncing, right?
That's supposed to be a gif of them actually fighting.
Yeah, we got it. So we got the wrestling and the biting.
There you go.
And then Frodo appearing, right? So we see the shot first of him actually grappling with an unseen thing, right? So him with his legs wrapped around something we can't see, the biting, and then Frodo's pain, okay? Mm-hmm. And then we get Frodo has fallen down. He's not even in this shot. Is he like somewhere off down to the bottom, I think?
I guess so.
Collapsed down on the ground. But then we get this shot of just Gollum. So once again, we're up above. The light is brighter, like the lava's brighter. And there's Gollum holding the ring up in his fingers and looking at it. And kind of staggering backwards, right? But then Frodo gets up and attacks him, and we get the two of them in almost in silhouette, right?
Yeah.
The two of them almost in silhouette fighting over the ring at the edge and then both falling off, and then the shot cuts immediately to just Gollum still staring up at the ring while he plummets downwards. And at this moment we don't know what's happened with Frodo, right?
Yeah.
And then we see Gollum hit. And again, him holding the ring up on his palm, looking up at it, that sort of, this I think is the, in my mind, this is like the famous, you know, shot, right? Both of these shots, the shot of the ring itself floating on the lava and then dissolving. And the hand, right? The hand of Gollum holding the ring up above the lava. And then of course we get Sam plunging forward, looking down in horror at where Frodo fell, and seeing Frodo clinging to to the rock and reaching down his hand. We had talked last time about the whole, let it go, and then hold on, right? That thing that goes on with Sam and Frodo there, and then we get the shot of Barad-dûr crumbling, right?
And the panic die.
Yeah, you got the panicked eye, and then, you know, the thing collapsing and the panicked eye looking around, and then boom, the thing explodes across the terrain there. And I think that's it. We got you gave me some.
No, you can skip that for now. So go back to those first ones, that was just so you could kind of get like a pretend storyboard idea.
Yeah.
But exactly what Corey was doing, like, let's talk through some of those, because what's so interesting to me is the shots that we get that tell stories in different ways.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's still a Frodo holding the ring in his hand is just iconic. We're all familiar with that. But if you just take that as like a little case study, I imagine they held that shot up against that first shot we get of Frodo reading under the tree where he's innocent and pale and blue-eyed and clean and said, let's make sure we are showing the exact opposite, the complete inverse of the Frodo we see at the beginning. And you can see just his clothes are deterred, is, you know, covered in soot, he's filthy, everything's just a wreck. And that is purposeful. Also just his stance, you know, he's not this like bumbly little innocent, strong and powerful, like, there's so many elements of this that are just showing us a changed Frodo.
Yeah.
And we get that medium shot too. So like, this is not any kind of establishing shot to show us where we are and what we're doing. We're focused in on Frodo. Where we get the establishing shot is that next image. I'm gonna scroll up one.
Yeah.
super reminiscent of Isildur at the beginning. And also I love this for the like graphic novelness of it. You can just tell where the light sources are and how powerful that is. The color palette's pretty muted. Our focus is wholly supposed to be on taking in all that information. So that top one, dangerous, terrifying, treacherous, powerful, really on the precipice, which way are we going to go? All of that uncertainty is there in that one very dangerous image drawing us down into the lava. So it just feels like a pool. And that's very emotive and that's very reactive. I don't know, it makes me feel kind of sick looking at it, and not just because of the height thing. I'm not bothered by heights. I'm bothered by falling into a pit of lava. And then with the bottom one, that gives us the perspective. It's a really beautiful shot of the only way out is back there. The only way in is through there. We are stuck on this precipice. There's nowhere else to go. It just adds to that feeling of like solitude and complete removal from their friends that are over there, but also harkens back to the shot that we had of Isildur not destroying it. So here we are again, repeating the same story. Is it going to happen? Is he going to drop it? Is he not? That's just visuals, you know? And then we get all these lines from Sam making him in charge of this moment and pushing Frodo and really moving him along to have some action happen, which is quite different from the book, but that is what we need. So we're moving that pacing forward. So I mean, all these things are happening just in these really simple moments.
Look at the one thing that strikes me here looking at these two pictures. Look at the way the both shots feature in the background like pointed rock projections, right? And in the top one, they're all like pointing down, like the lava is the center, right? Everything is pointing
Drawing
downwards into, like
in.
it's you're every your the eye is just completely drawn past Frodo down into the lava, right?
Doesn't it look like the teeth of the sandworms in Dune?
Yes, exactly. Like the spiral in, yes, exactly. And then we see pointed rock projections behind Sam, and they're a row like a picket fence, right? Showing like this, as you said, it's the way out, right? And they really emphasize it's not just like, oh, look, here's this silhouette of a door in the background where you can see pale daylight, which is a light of a totally different texture than the light, you know, the fiery light that's in the room. That itself would be a significant contrast, right? Even though the light outside is hardly blue sky and bright sunshine, right? And yet it's
It's still
still,
light against dark.
yeah, exactly. But again, it's still of a very different color and quality, the kind of like slightly like rosy pink thing that we get. It's just very different. And compare the when we were outside in that light, it looked kind of bleak and horrible and washed out color and everything, like in the scenes previous to this, right? But from here in the you know, in the orange glow of the lava everywhere, it looks like cool and inviting, right? That doorway. But again, so that effect would happen anyway. But the projected, you know, the fence of rocky points there makes it even clearer, right? Like this is the path, this is the way, this, you know, come this way to go to safety.
And there's no out. You know, you're just stuck there. Like you can't keep going. It's only in and out that door. So like you either throw something in the fire or you die, right? Like there's just not any other option there. You don't come by there for a nice picnic spot.
Alan has some really interesting questions here. First of all, he was noticing that in the flashback, their positions are reversed. Isildur, like Elrond, is like dragging Isildur towards the fire, right? And in the especially in the final shot when Isildur is turning to go, right? And or not Elendil, sorry, Elrond is left there crying out, you know, Isildur, right? You know, there he's standing on the end towards the fire, right? Throw it in the fire. He's inviting him to come, throw it in the fire. But Isildur is the one towards the door, and then he turns and walks away over there.
I don't know if I would read into that. I'd have to think about that, but I don't think I would immediately read into that as they are reversing roles. I think that probably shows more that Isildur had already made his mind up and was on the move out. So there was no deterring. Elrond was trying to pull him back and say, "Please throw it into the fire." Like he was committed to being at the edge to throw that into the fires, and Isildur had already left that option behind. The reversal of it doesn't put any realm of power in either of their hands by reversing that. So I can't see a reason that that would be a conscious choice, except timing, that Frodo was still in process and Isildur had already finished making a decision. So maybe we just join that shot in a different moment. The door on the left and the right, I think, is interesting. Like, I definitely have talked a lot about perspective and what you're looking at from left to right. So, like, that bottom shot of Sam, I just love how it's framed because it is classic storyboard and graphic novel rule of thirds. Like, it just ticks all the boxes of what is visually pleasing to the eye. And I think the movement of the light on the left side is actually drawing you towards it. So, while normally we're going left to right, because we cannot go forward, like we've already said that there is no in and out. This is not a picnic spot. You have to go back. So because we have no forward progression, the only way out is to reverse. So instead of moving to the right, we're going to move to the left in this respect, and that feels right. So having the door, that feels correct, I should say. So having the door on his left, I think, is the same physical pull that we see in that like road progression left to right across the screen. At least, I mean, I feel that decision would be how I would pitch that one. Because there's forward progression, that is forward progression.
And Sam is still, even though Sam is still facing in the forward direction, right? Isildur is about to turn and do the retrograde action thing, right? He's going to turn his back and walk away. Sam is, I mean, obviously you're right about this path being the way out. The only way forward is there, but the way forward goes past the cracks of doom, right? You've got to first come out to the end and throw the ring in, and then you can go
And you get to
back,
return.
right?
Yeah. And Isildur had already done that part of the journey.
And Isildur was turning away from that final step, so his motion is a retrograde motion, right? Whereas Sam is still, he's still progressing. So if the door is to the left of him, where from where we're sitting, he's still implicitly moving left to right, right? And he's still facing away. And he's not calling Frodo to return. He's calling him to let the ring go, right? And then comes the implicit invitation to remain, you know, to come back, to escape, to live.
Yeah, and then we actually have that visual progression, don't we? Because the next shot, right, is Frodo and Gollum, but it's from the perspective of Sam. So we are then in Sam's shoes with our back to the door, watching this unfold. So in terms of perspective, that still tracks that we're looking the correct way.
Though
Because the
Frodo
decision.
isn't here.
No.
Frodo isn't here. Frodo is facing back towards the door, but with the ring on his finger and not thrown in the lava, right? So, because he's made the decision. I mean, that's the thing that's happening at that first moment, right? When
Do we
he's.
see how Elrond and Isildur walk in? Is Isildur in front and Elrond's behind? Or do we not get to see that
I
part?
think Elrond is in front. He's leading him to the cracks of doom, is what I recall.
Because I don't think, yeah, I think you're right. And I don't think we ever have that moment with this. Frodo's always known his mission is to throw it into the fire. He doesn't get this wobble until he's at the edge. Whereas it was kind of the other way around for most of it with Isildur, that Elrond was like, "You will throw this in the fire." And we don't know necessarily what decision Frodo would have made in this situation had Gollum not jumped on him and
Well,
turned
I
it
mean, he had
into
already
that.
made a decision, right? To not throw the ring in the fire, right, and to keep it for himself. What would have happened next, right, and how that would have panned out if Gollum hadn't been there is the thing we certainly can't know. Yeah, I love that. I had not been thinking about, but you're right. The juxtaposition between the very first time we see Frodo when he stands up after reading, like when he stands up upon hearing Gandalf's cart in the lane, right? And that first view, this first medium shot view we have of him with his bright, fresh,
Baby
face
face.
looking like he's 14 years old, you know?
Literally, he was like, wasn't that his first scene? He was 17 when that was
Yeah,
shot.
exactly. Anyway, yeah, so yeah, the freshness of that, even just the bright fairness of that and the darkness here.
And the colors, like this really is a very sepia toned palette. We don't have a lot of saturation going on here, whereas Hobbiton, we have those rich greens, the tall grass, the dappled sunlight. There's a lot of depth and perspective and shape, and all of that gives you a certain feeling of a safe summer afternoon. And we have none of that with this. This is
Yes.
devoid of any kind of characteristic because all of the drama is focused in on this character and these rocks and
Yes.
this setting. So we
Yeah.
don't need the nuance of all these other things.
Yeah, and I love you mentioned the detail of his eyes too. You know, Elijah Wood's eyes look radiant, bright periwinkle blue in that first scene, right? In that first shot. And here they're like slate gray, right? Almost no color at all, just dark. I also love, by the way, the blood on his neck, like the chain of the ring has,
The
worn
weight.
him raw. It does give you that sense of the weight of the ring, which of course is such a big emphasis in the book, how heavy the ring is on him. And it's a very subtle, but really, I mean, anyone who has had a raw, open wound like that on the skin, it just the pain of that.
But then also seeing the progression of that. Like, I remember recognizing that and noticing it. And then, upon every rewatch, seeing when it starts to get red and then when it starts to get cut in and then when it starts to puff, because there's actual swelling around the edges of that wound. And then it starts to gape. Like, it becomes a very substantial wound. So that's a very specific decision to reveal that over time. So by the time we get to here, that's. Yeah, looks like he's been massacred.
Yes, the wound and the blood, the dried blood and the dirt and the filth. But you can still see so clearly his hobbit clothing. I mean, he's still wearing a waistcoat, right? He's still wearing, his sort of blousy hobbit sleeves. It's, Okay. Anyway, so sorry. I'm kind of going back and forth here.
We do.
Yeah, it's okay.
I'm enjoying the chat too. I don't remember how it comes off the chain. Doesn't Frodo just pull it off his neck though, which always makes me grimace with that wound?
Yes, I think he does, so that when he puts it on, presumably the chain can just slip
Chain is
off and he'll.
broken.
Yeah, I don't think he pulls it over his head. I think he just yanks it. I think. Anyway, I'm interested in the lighting. So we go from the, as you say, sort of sepia tone, light, sort of mist, fog, smoke background
The
behind
fog is
Frodo.
ex and the fog's an excellent tool here because the only actual source of light is coming from whatever sun might be coming through the top of Mount Doom, which we can assume is pretty minimal, or that tiny shaft of light that's coming in the door, which we can assume is pretty minimal. So the only light source we actually know about is the glow of the lava. So using the smoke is a really clever way to, like, technically, like production-wise, just to light an actor's face. So if you have a ton of smoke, then you can pretend the glow is coming up through that, because otherwise it would be super dark.
Yeah, so you've got the and it's and it makes for one of the things that I find fascinating here is that it makes for a a light background, like almost a white background, in several of these shots. Most notably, the one where Frodo's holding up the ring. We get a sort of the darker background, except for the doorway behind Sam, right? So the from a lighting perspective, it's all about the two in the Sam shot. It's all about the two things, right? It's about the white light coming in the door, and the red light. Red firelight on Sam's face, and like his face is a totally different color from behind, right? Because that light behind him, we're not seeing it on him, we're just seeing the firelight that he's facing.
Although in that one, it does look like there might be some rays of brightness coming down from on top, because you can see,
On the right there.
and from the top left of that shot, you can kind of see like brightness around like the clouds coming down. So it almost looks like moonbeams or something, but maybe that is a tiny bit of sun coming in through the top of Mount Doom.
Yeah.
Either way,
Maybe.
minimal.
I don't know. Of course, in the top down Frodo shot, we just get the orange light of the lava, right? And we don't get any, and there's none of the white light from the door is visible here. It's all just the lava light. With,
Sorry, I'm
yeah,
cutting
go
you
ahead.
off. Even the lava light part, though, I like, though, because if you watch video of lava, like, again, not a geologist, I'm sure there's somebody's even said it, I'm sure there's some comments from volcano experts on these scenes,
Yeah,
but
yeah.
if you watch footage of lava, it's black and charred, and the orange kind of cracks through as the lava moves.
Yeah.
So for it to be this red and molten means we are in the heart, right? Like, it never cools. It is
Right.
so hot and so molten that it's never going to get to the point of being anything other than bright and glowing red.
Yes. When Gollum is on Frodo's back, right, on invisible Frodo's back. We once again have the smoke background, just like when Frodo was claiming the ring for himself and holding it up on its chain, right? Except this is even it's even brighter. It's a little bit more yellowy than it was behind. Like the light is a little bit more like orange and yellow. But again, almost totally sepia tone here. We get almost no, especially when we come back to Frodo's face. Let me see if I can pause it here. Okay. Yeah, when we come back to Frodo's face, it's again, there's no shades at all. It's everything is drowned out by the white, the orangey whitish light from behind them. It's all very yellow and orange.
Gollum's eyes look terrifying there.
They really do. Yeah, I can't.
Oof. But
Yeah.
yeah, that's a really good shot to just look at the color. Like, that really could just be a sepia toned photograph.
Yeah, it really is. Even the difference in shades, even like the darkness of Frodo's face, we don't see that anymore. We're seeing the light on his face. And this is the light. This light is the light. I'm trying to figure out like what visually they're inviting us to associate with the light. By which I mean the background behind the wrestling matches, again, is almost the same as this when Frodo's holding the ring, right? You know what it's almost reminding me of? It's not the same, but it's almost reminding me of how, like when you put the ring on, right? Throughout the film, they have like that like washed out ring world, right? Like the where you can't see the world around you normally, and everything is and the color tones are all washed out and blurred and everything else, right? It's almost like when he's holding up the ring and focused on the ring and going to take the ring, it's like the rest of the world doesn't exist, right? We just see him really clearly, him in the ring in front of this vague, washed out background, which is again not an identical effect in any way to what we see in the ring thing. But do you see what I mean about kind of reminding me of that? Except, of course, it's lit up by the fire itself. So it's still predominantly the yellow light of the lava of the cracks of doom, which is the heart of Sauron's power on Earth, right? So where the power of the ring itself comes from. So it's almost like the ring, the power of the ring, like is the whole backdrop, right? Is, And then, and we don't, when we're here in the Frodo and Sam shots, right? We don't have that background because that's not where we are. Like, we're not being invited into that space.
We're being invited into those characters, into those people.
And like, so like Frodo, we're looking down on Frodo, right? But we're not looking like at Frodo's perspective, right? We're like, this is inviting us to sort of see Frodo from afar, right? Correct. And then we're seeing, because we're not even seeing Sam's point of view, because Sam doesn't see his scalp, right? The way we're seeing straight down, right, onto Frodo there. And then when we see Sam, we don't get any of that, you know, the ring blurring thing. But then again, with Gollum and Frodo, it's all over that again, right? It's nothing but that. Nothing else exists except the two of them and the struggle for the ring, as they're both entirely focused on the ring and getting it and claiming it or trying to keep it, right?
Yeah.
Because then when Gollum has the ring, now we're back to the top down, right?
Yep.
Just like we were with Frodo, except Gollum is turned the other way. He's turned the other way and he's looking up. Frodo was facing the other direction and looking down. Gollum is 180 degrees reversed and he's looking up, not at us, right? He's looking at the ring, but we're looking down on him, on the ring and him, as he is looking up, and the light from the lava is much, much brighter. And the whole thing is more orange. And I mean, it was pretty dark before with Frodo. Mm-hmm. I mean, okay, the light of the lava is bright, but like the stone was dark in contrast.
And, I mean, the only caveat I would say here is that these are random screenshots from the internet. So we don't actually know if these are the exact gradings that came. This could be lightened by a fan or something, but even if you just took this as a breakdown, like, you can tell that the white of that lava is more pure than the white of a previous shot. So like the brightness of this frame is just a lot higher.
Mm-hmm.
And having Gollum at the center of that shot, like perfectly framed, is like, if you squint a little bit, it's like the pupil of an eye,
right?
Really drawing our focus straight into him as the character. So yeah, the power is not on the ring right here. The power is not the power. The focus is on,
right,
is on Gollum.
Is on Gollum. Yes, the ring is not even tech. Like, you know, he's holding the ring, but you can't see it. Right. This is all about him, and we get him staggering here. And this, of course, this is the moment where, we're rotating, right? What do you make of that rotation?
I like the drawing up. So
right.
we start close on him and it's like a crane shot lifting up. So he's getting smaller. It's like, he's so infatuated with the ring that it's like, this ethereal,
yeah,
to him, blissful moment. He's reunited with his love. He's feeling nothing but the swirling swoon of love. And I kind of feel that with this.
Yes.
Love is a tough term for it, but I think that's probably the vibe that we're getting of just, I don't know, it feels like bliss.
And I love how in this shot, the ring starts off further away from him and then comes in close to his face, right? So
And it matches the swirl of the smoke. Like, he's kind of following the same trajectory.
Yes, yeah, I didn't even notice the swirling smoke. But yes, you're right. You're right. In fact, you're talking about, you know, it's almost like he and the ring are moving in for a kiss.
I mean, it really feels like this super intimate moment. He's been separated from his true love.
Yeah.
He has felt nothing but heartache for two movies. And really wants to be reunited with him. And here we are in this moment watching this reunion, and it's just nothing but bliss. And like, visually, it's also helpful to have that cyclone of smoke, because it keeps things interesting, right? So if there was no smoke in this shot, we would just have a crane shot of Gollum in the middle. But having that moving smoke, I think, still gives like a little bit of a threat element too, and just shows us things are still moving. Like, we're not quite fixed and safe here.
Right. But here's what's... So here's now where we start getting to the moment in this scene where they do make significant changes from the text. Because Gollum, he is got his back to the cracks of doom, and he is backing up, like closer to the precipice, right? But of course, in the book, let's go back to the book. Don't need to just summarize it, because it's right here. So we get, suddenly, Sam saw Gollum's long hands draw upward to his mouth. And I love, as you pointed out, in both book and film, we're getting this explicitly from Sam's point of view, right? We're seeing what Sam sees. Suddenly, Sam saw Gollum's long hands draw upward to his mouth. His white fangs gleamed and then snapped as they bit. Frodo gave a cry, and there he was, fallen upon his knees at the chasm's edge. But Gollum, dancing like a mad thing, held aloft the ring, a finger still thrust within its circle. It shone now as if verily it was wrought of living fire. He cries out, precious, precious, precious. And with that, even as his eyes were lifted up to gloat on his prize, he stepped too far, toppled, wavered for a moment on the brink, and then with a shriek he fell. So notice how much more motion we get from Gollum. He is dancing like a mad thing, right? He's capering around in joy. So on the one hand, his joy is more effusive in the book than this, like, sort of staggering backward one or two steps that we see him doing in the film, right? And there are some other really interesting word choices that we get. The other one that I would point to is gloat. Even as his eyes were lifted up to gloat on his prize, right? I think I agree with you that in the film version, we're getting... he's not gloating there. It is, he's adoring.
Adoring.
That he's adoring. He's not gloating. Exactly.
Doesn't he, sorry, I should have rewatched it before we start talking, but doesn't he then like skip about like a small child and then Frodo attacks him?
And then Frodo attacks him. Yeah. So there is some capering.
Some capering.
Yeah. A certain amount of capering does in fact still happen.
Oh, yeah, Alan says the same thing. Yeah, I think there is a little bit of a jaunty
right
pop.
But, of course, the this leads to the significant change, right? Which is he doesn't go off on his own. Frodo comes after him. Frodo plays no more role after his finger is bitten off in the book. The rest Gollum does himself. It's all Gollum and the ring. After that, this is what we explicitly don't get in the book.
And look how fuzzy it is.
Yeah, the smoke now.
And the perspective. Like, look how far away we are watching this. So, like, yeah. I don't know. There already feels like a separation. Like, is that happening? Is that real? It feels ethereal. And that takes you back to what you were pointing out about the power of the ring being the focal point here. If you are under the power of the ring, everything around you becomes muted and fuzzy.
Yes.
That works with this. The two of them are only focused on this one thing. Everything else disappears.
They're looking
at it away.
And they're both further away, including or perhaps especially Frodo. Right. Again, we go back to not there. We go back to here. Right. The shot of Frodo's face that we get here, right, as he's screaming out in pain as his finger gets bitten off. We talked about the color and how washed out he is, and yet he's perfectly clear to be seen. We're really close to him, right? The experience of his pain is right there in our face. We can see his individual teeth. We can see the light reflecting off his uvula in the back of his throat. We're right there in his face, right? Yeah. But then when he turns and goes to tackle Gollum back, he is now, we can't even barely make out his whole outline. At
like
any given
we can
time.
Tell which one is which, but it's there's nothing specific about either of them here.
Both of them, like, so Frodo is further away. Frodo is almost lost, and both of them are being lost in this haze and this fog. I'm like in this theory seemed to be working out about how to interpret the smoke, right? If the smoke as the What the draw of the ring, the power of the ring, the distortion of the world, that you know, the sort of the cloud that the ring puts over the rest of the world, and now both Gollum and Frodo are receding into it, right? Both of them are being absorbed, and Sam, who is still presumably our spectator here, is further and further away, right? What was he going back to the text, the screenplay text? I mean, he's saying, "Go on, throw it in the fire. What are you waiting for? Just let it go."
It's
And then
not
he.
just one line, it's multiple lines. Go
Yes.
on, destroy it. And it's not, please, Mr. Frodo, put it in the
Yes.
fire. It's a command. Like, he is now the one in charge. Destroy it.
Right. And then he
Yeah.
says, "No." Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So ironically, you know, he's like, "Go on, destroy the ring," but here Frodo has gone on, right? But not in the way that Sam wanted him to. He's gone away from Sam. By the way, so Brave Brown Bear, I
Yeah, I'm
wanna,
catching up on questions and comments here.
I just wanna bring out a comment you're making here. Is it possible that the choice of having Gollum and Frodo fighting in the smoke is also due to the technical difficulty in combining a real and a CGI character in a fight? So possibly, but that doesn't explain it. There may well be a technical challenge to surmount here, but it can be surmounted in multiple different ways, right? The choice that they're making, and not to mention the fact, by the way, there are technical difficulties to be overcome in a written narrative as well, in what you can describe and how you can describe it and how much and how quickly you can describe it. So
I mean,
I'm
I
always
think.
less interested in thinking of like, because to say that there is a constraint is not to say that the outcome is inescapable. Like how one deals with the constraints of one's art is a fundamental part of the artistry of anything involved there, if you see what I mean. So, it may well be that that contributes to this, but they chose to overcome that in a way that created this effect instead of a different effect.
Yeah, I would say something similar. It's just like it might be handy that this is easier to manage than CG effects on something like that, but I don't think that would be a driving force. It's like, oh, that's a bonus.
Okay, so then we see the two of them both go over, right? And so there's that transition from them both falling.
And
Gollum is
considering
further
somehow Frodo
away.
grabs on, we don't have to think about too hard.
No. Frodo is between us and Gollum here, right? So they're never really side by side. Though it's hard to tell, it becomes clear, I think, when they fall that Gollum is the further away and Frodo is closer in. That feels important to me, right? Like Frodo is just one step less far gone into the ring haze than Gollum is, which, and to me, in my experience of receiving this story that they're telling me there, that's actually enough for me. With what you were just saying, like, how does he catch on to the cliff? To me, that's less about physics than it is about, like, the narrative, right? Frodo is almost gone, but he's not quite gone, right?
Yeah, I mean, everything points to the eventuality that he would just follow Gollum into the fire,
Yes.
but he doesn't. He reaches a hand out and somehow grabs onto that rock.
Right. He
So there's
doesn't quite. Yeah.
right.
Yeah.
There's something, even if he's not conscious of it, that like makes his arm go out and grab rock instead of diving down after Gollum.
Yeah. It's so the reason I don't have a problem with this physically is the same reason that I my wife is a physician and she gets really annoyed watching action movies with me and watching like two guys beat each other up with like, metal objects and things. And she's a doctor and she's like, do you know what that would have done to his internal organs? Like, do you know how many broken ribs that guy would have right now? He couldn't possibly be physically holding on to that. And I'm just like,
Suspend.
suspend. Okay. You're like, that's not like, this is not what this story is not asking us to ask these questions right now. Right. And I feel exactly the same way here. Right. The point is about where Frodo is placed. Right. His clinging to the rocks is not something that I'm not even asking the question, how plausible is it that he grabbed, successfully grabbed the stone and caught himself on the way down? How hard would that be to do in real life, especially with a finger freshly bitten off and, blood still pumping out of your hand? They do show his hand bloody, but anyway, whatever. The point is that's not what the narrative is asking me here, right? The narrative is showing me Frodo, a Frodo who almost who didn't almost go over the edge. He did go over the edge with Gollum into that ring smoke. And now look, the ring smoke is hovering around both. There's Sam like emerging from the ring smoke and holding his hand out to Frodo, right? Frodo has already taken one step. He caught himself on the edge of the rocks. He didn't go over with Gollum. He almost went as far as Gollum did, but not quite. Again, Gollum was one step further. Frodo was between us and Gollum as they toppled over their shadows, right?
And I'm looking at the angle of this again, too. We have Sam on the left, so I wonder if there is something in this scene about the opportunity for escape is always on the left. That Sam is top left, moving us that direction. Frodo's occupying the entire right half of the screen. Like everything else, that previous shot of Gollum, that's drawing us down. Everything else was drawing us down, and this
Yes.
is drawing us up.
Yes. Yeah, as Alan says, it's interesting that in this shot Sam and Frodo are in that mist fog. Yeah, except again, I think what we're seeing here is Sam emerging out of it. Like, notice how there's like a gradient on Sam's body, right? The what to us the left-hand side of Sam's body is foggy with the smoke, right? We can't really see clearly Sam's right shoulder, but as we move from left to right, our eyes move from left to right across Sam's body, it becomes clearer and clearer into focus, right? Until like we get the strongest focus on his hand, right, reaching out to Frodo. So it really is, it's like Sam's head and left arm emerging out of the smoke. Clearly, I think, offering to pull, I mean, he's offering to pull him up off the cliff, but also I think sort of out of that smoke. And because we saw him, Frodo was thoroughly surrounded by the smoke when he was fighting
Yeah,
with Gollum.
I like Alan's point here. He's reaching into Frodo's world of struggle within the ring. So he's
Yes.
cutting through that murk to bring clarity, right? Like, come on, Frodo, get out of this. Yeah, that's really interesting.
No, I think that works really well.
Eric King said, would you consider this a Dutch angle? I wouldn't. This is just a frame shot of a funny angle. Dutch angle would kilt us this way, and the camera would be fixed in like a 45 degree space. And this is more just an upshot, I think, because nothing's really purposely setting us off balance. We're just in a funny place on the rock with him.
Yeah, the edge of the rock isn't flat across the screen, but it
But we're
does.
straight on. It's just the rock is a bit wonky. If you don't know Dutch angle, sorry, but should probably say that we talked about it at length in Rings of Power because there was a whole scene with Adar that was shot with a Dutch angle, and that basically just fixes the camera at an angle, usually around 45 degrees, but it can be different, and it's like locked in at that angle.
Yeah.
And the whole purpose is to just make you feel unsettled, and it works quite well.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So back to Gollum. Gollum falling into the lava, holding his hand up, right? And this moment, the moment that you've frozen in this image on the top left, is what is often characterized as like the look of betrayal when it looks, you know, he's even as he's falling, as we get in the after he and Frodo fall, right? And we get the like even as he's falling to his death, he's still just like deliriously happy looking at the ring, right? All the way down, he's like unaware of the fact that he's falling. He doesn't seem to care at all. And again, that is the, to me, the point in contrast with Frodo still clinging to the stone, right? He's made a choice in doing that. Anyway, so his gaze is fixed entirely on the ring. But then we see his gaze still on the ring. It's not in his fingers anymore, it's on his palm. And his expression is now one of pain and, you know, is he upset? Does he feel betrayed? Possibly.
Yeah. I mean, again, if we want to think about it in terms of the fog, he was in the fog the whole of the fall. He
Yes.
was just, blissed out and happy in his fog, and then hits the lava, and that cuts through it real quick. And it's discombobulation and perhaps betrayal and anger, but clarity probably more than anything else.
Yes, the
That's
clarity
true.
that the ring has destroyed him as well. But I don't know. Like, I was never certain about this. I've heard people say this before about like that Gollum gives like feels betrayed. I've also wondered at this moment, when he's looking at the ring, I'm not 100% convinced that his thoughts are the ring betrayed me, but rather that he knows the ring is going to be destroyed. Like
I
that
always
he's
took it
worried
as
for the
a,
ring.
I don't know if it's for the ring, but it wasn't betrayal. I mean, like it was more of, oh crap, and maybe that was his own self-preservation, but I think you're right, that could absolutely be the ring. Like it's destruction, not betrayal. He's still attached to the ring.
Yes. I mean, in the book, it's very explicit. I'm trying to remember if he says it in the film. You must not hurt Precious, right? Like, he's very explicit. When they're about to go into the Cracks of Doom, he knows that the ring will be destroyed if it goes into the Cracks of Doom, and that he must, you know, he is like determined to prevent that from happening. So yes, even the way in which we see him holding it up as if like to the last that he has, he's trying to save the life of the ring. Again, yeah, like I was never sure whether to read his expression as like I have been betrayed to my death by the thing that I loved, or whether it's oh no, I'm now suddenly realizing I have caused the destruction of the thing that I love, right? I have taken the ring myself into the fire. Yes, JJ was saying the same thing. He's almost trying to save the ring even at the end. Yes. Yeah, it seems that way. And that's, by the way, one of the things that I read in the shift of the position, the him holding the ring between thumb and forefinger was his, like, that's the position whereby you contemplate the ring, right? Here, I even have one. Look, I've got a prop. This is actually my wedding ring, which I haven't been able to wear since I broke my finger doing karate. So I broke my finger right by the knuckle.
Put it on a chain around
Put
your
on a chain
neck.
around my
Really
neck, then
kill the
nobody will ask any
stereotype
questions.
here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no one will be freaked out by that at all. But anyway, so when he's holding up the ring, and this happens more than once in the film, Frodo holds up the ring. like we get the whole like seeing an eye through the ring, you know, is a thing that we get in the film. And when he's doing his ecstatic contemplation thing, he's holding the ring in thumb and forefinger. When he shifts to holding it up on his palm like that, it seems to me like it's not like I'm still looking at the ring, or he'd be holding it still like this. He's got it. He's lifting it up, right? That's how I read that gesture. I
Like
do
you would
think
if you
he's
were
still trying
carrying
to save
something
it.
in water.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Trying to keep it out of the fire. Anyway, the whole little mini drama that we get of the ring floating on the one like cooler patch of lava.
I was just going to comment on that, of like my previous comment where we have no cool patches of lava and that's where the glow is coming from. So the fact that the lava kind of cools and gathers underneath it, like it is also trying to lift it up and protect it and keep
Yes.
it safe and create a little raft, and then it just can't. Like, yeah, that's really powerful. And I remember that visual too. This is before I studied anything Tolkien or even read the books. That visual, it just was powerful, powerful, must support, and then it just dissolves. It was so impactful. Yeah, I think that was really well played out. That would have been so easy to just be like, flick, tossed it in the fire. But nope, we're going to show the fire fighting back. We're going to show the words appearing, meaning, it's ignited, it's activated, and then we're going to show the absolute dissolving destruction of it. Very cool process.
So, going back to the text for a second. So, on the one hand, okay, first, another acknowledgement here. This is another major change. I think that people, and this is a major change that's really interesting because it's a change people don't notice. I see some of you, Phil and others, were talking about how it is untrue to physics that Gollum would sink into the lava. Like he would have to weigh tons in order to sink into the lava. It's really funny because I just got an email from, I get a bunch of random emails with people pointing out things or asking questions about Tolkien. That's been happening for many years now. And I just recently got a random email from somebody pointing out exactly this thing. It's like, why would Gollum sink into the lava? He wouldn't sink into the lava. Like it's liquid, but it's still stone. It's still very dense. Like Gollum would never sink into the lava. But the interesting thing about this question is, it seemed to be a book qu question. Like he's the premise of the email seemed to be, unless I'm misunderstanding it, that he thought this was a problem with Tolkien's depiction, right? But it's not a problem with Tolkien's depiction. It's just a film issue entirely. Remember what we see, right? Back to the passage I just read. He stepped too far, toppled, wavered for a moment on the brink, and then with a shriek, he fell. Out of the depths came his last wail, Precious! And he was gone. There was a roar and a great confusion of noise. Fires leaped up and licked the roof. We never see it. We don't see the ring go into the lava. It all happens off screen. Gollum's death, Gollum's plummet down, his hitting the lava, the ring going into the lava and actually melting. We never see it. Tolkien doesn't describe it at all. We hear Gollum's voice coming up as he falls into the cracks of doom, but we don't actually see the thing happening. So, what are they doing? Why are they giving us this? Why is it that they're now again? I call this a change. Like the biggest sort of plot difference, I would say, is the fact that Frodo tackles him and the whole like Sam pulling Frodo up the cliff and stuff, and Sam, you know, Frodo holding onto the edge of the cliff and everything. That's not in the book, right? As far as like plot sequence, that's probably the biggest change that's made here. But I actually think the sequence, wonderful sequence on film, though it is, of Gollum falling down while looking at the ring and hitting the lava and falling into the lava, and then the ring floating on the little lava raft and then dissolving. None of that is in the book. How does Tolkien convey what's going on here? Or rather, again, thinking about this act of translation that we're talking about, right? What is there something in the book that's being translated here? This is not just an addition, right? Because I don't think it's merely an addition. It's Tolkien does not describe it that way. But again, I think this is all about the tools, like the tools at the disposal of a work of literature versus the tools at the disposal of a filmmaker, right? What do we get? Notice what Tolkien gives us that the film doesn't give us. And far away as Frodo put on the ring and claimed it for his own, even in Samothnaur, the very heart of his realm, the power in Barad-dûr was shaken, and the tower trembled from its foundations to its proud and bitter crown. The Dark Lord was suddenly aware of him, and his eye, piercing all shadows, looked across the plain to the door that he had made, and the magnitude of his own folly was revealed to him in a blinding flash. This is what we don't get in the film. Right? Because this is the kind of thing you can do really well and with comparative ease in narrative, right? As the narrator shifts and gives us a paragraph telling us what Sauron is thinking, right? That's really hard to do in a film, right?
I feel like you still get some of that in the panicked eyeball falling, though. Like, there's emotion in that panicked eyeball that is not the same as this. But if you're going to try to take the feeling from this paragraph and put it into the floating eyeball, that's how I would do it.
Yes, but the floating eyeball, the moving up to the panicked eyeball, but the panicked eyeball. There are several things I dislike about the panicked eyeball. The fact that it kind of becomes comical is one reason, but the panicked eye, the other thing that I don't like about it, is that I do feel that the panicked eyeball is an attempt to capture what Tolkien was doing there. But I think that of all of the things that we've been talking about, all of the things that they're trying to capture and the things that they're doing with the visuals, that's the one that for me fails most fully, I think. Because the panicked eyeball, if I had to put ca a caption under the panicked eyeball moment, my caption would be, "What's happening?"
Or
Right, exactly. Like just panic and confusion is what it conveys to me. And panic, yes. Confusion, no. The reason he's panicked is that he knows exactly what's happening, right? And so even when the tower is in mid-collapse, right? The ring has already been destroyed, and the tower and the eyeball's looking around like, oh no, wait, what's happening? What's happening? And that's not what Sauron is feeling at that moment. He knows precisely what has happened. And it's already happened. It's already occurring. Like the fall has happened. It's too late for the eyeball to be looking around in panic. And it shouldn't be panicking in that way anyway. So the eyeball panic thing seems to me inadequate. Where I get the will of Sauron more is in the little lava raft, actually. Like the seeing the ring and like there's even a sense in which the agency of the ring itself is captured, right? Like why does Gen was good as Gollum fall off the cliff, right? I mean, like it's kind of random. He's just dancing around and then accidentally takes a step too far and tumbles off the cliff. Nobody pushes him, right? He just trips and falls into the cracks of doom, the end. That's the climax. Why? That's not, though, it's not, but it's not unsatisfying. It seems like it should be unsatisfying, but it's not unsatisfying. One of the reasons it's not unsatisfying is that we've been set up for it several times before. Frodo told Gollum, if you ever again try to take the ring from me, you'll be cast yourself into the cracks of doom. If you ever demand the ring from me again, I will put on the ring and I will command you to throw yourself off of a cliff, he says to Gollum, right? All of these things like prepare us, and then you see like when it happens, you're like, oh my gosh. And by what power? How does Frodo have the power to do this? By the power of the ring. The ring's power brings about the very oath that Gollum swore an oath on the precious not to betray Frodo, right? So I mean, all of this stuff is in play there, right? The ring itself has brought about its own destruction, and the way in which we see the ring. So again, I love the lava raft. I love the lava raft. This sense of not just of suspense, right? Not merely to kind of drag it out, right? But to show the kind of the conflicting power. That's how it's like the power of Sauron is trying to save it,
Trying to lift it
right?
up.
But
Yeah.
failing. And I think it's really
I think
cool.
that's a really lovely example too of if you know more of the text and you are more familiar with the lore, that's going to hit so much harder. But if you're not familiar with the lore and you've never read these books before, you're still going to understand that this is a last ditch effort or something, there's something that's still going to sink into you from that visual. That's really a skill to be able to kind of show that level of understanding. And I don't think it's fan service. It doesn't feel gimmicky. It's an interpretation. It's a way to show that.
One last thing, because we're over time already, but one last quick thing that I'd love to hear you comment on, Maggie. I was describing the end, like how he does it happens off screen. Like, he doesn't show us. In the book, he doesn't show us. Like, it's not described. Gollum plummeting down, hitting the lava, catching on fire, the ring melting. The ring being destroyed doesn't actually happen on screen. Not that we have a screen,
Page.
right? But
Yeah.
it's not described. And somebody was saying, sorry, I'm forgetting who it was who was saying it just now, that like, but it's a common sentiment, right? People would say, but you couldn't do that in a movie, right? You can't not show it.
Yes, you can, but
Right.
the
Why
I mean,
not? Like, why does it work in the book to have that? Like, what's that?
but I
That's
can't
the last
like
thing I want to focus on.
sure, like big picture wise, I mean, we can't answer like the it doesn't always work that way. This specific example, there was a really choice decision made in the opening shot of the prologue where Sauron was not the baddie, the ring
Was the
baddie. Like
baddie, yeah.
there is a shot where they zoom straight in on the ring on his finger holding the sword, and all of a sudden we're not focused on the big bad with the helmet, we're focused on the big bad on his finger. The ring becomes the baddie.
Yeah, Sauron is an
And
accessory to the ring, not the other way around.
and we see that throughout the prologue. When it's being cut off, it's a tight shot on the ring as a central character taking up the entire frame. So the ring is the bad guy. So seeing the eye fall is not the destruction of the bad guy. Seeing the ring be destroyed is the destruction of the bad guy. So of course you could do that off screen, but that would like, I don't know, that's almost the same as like those cheesy spy movies when they're like, I'm just gonna assume everything goes to plan and you are destroyed over here while I go destroy the world over there. Like we need to see that visual confirmation. It was one of my big complaints about Harry Potter too, when Voldemort dissolves and evaporates into the air in Deathly Hallows. That's not what happens in the book. He's a dead body, and it's the dead body on the floor that is powerless. Like there's nothing to him anymore. The empty shell is what was so powerful about that moment. Seeing him turn into ether does not set me at ease because that's what happened when he became part of Quirrell's head. Like he had also dissolved into ether. So there were a lot of concerns with that. With something like this, we kind of need to see that visual confirmation. And again, if you're comparing folks that know the lore to people that don't know the lore, you're asking a big ask of your audience to go along for 12 hours with a ring as the bad guy if you're not going to show the destruction of that. So I think just in terms of satisfaction and punctuation on the piece, I think that has to happen. But has to happen is not a phrase anybody gets to use lightly. They can do whatever they want. They can still try to help that story. But it's really satisfying to see that ring try to be saved and then fall apart because we know that it is destroyed. We have seen that. We can confirm it. It's also a really good transition to what happens next. So just in terms of pacing, in the book, we're exhausted by the time that ring goes into the cracks of Mount Doom. We are exhausted. We have been on this journey with them, and we don't need to see that destruction because we understand and we're grateful for the rest too. But I think in film, there needs to be some downward action visually. So having that quiet moment after that fight with Frodo and Gollum going hand to hand, having that quiet moment of the ring just sitting there and then falling apart is a real exhale of, oh, it's gone. And then we transition to it's a screenshot I have, the second to last one of Sam and Frodo on the rock. That's a Dutch angle. to the Dutch angle shot of them out there. So we do have this transition of just, it's over. We're not okay yet, so we're gonna look at the world a little askew. And that's Dutch angle because you can tell the camera's just fixed in the wrong spot. You want to right it a little bit.
It's the slope of the mountain, but
Yeah, it just feels like you're looking at it like this. So I feel like you just kind of needed that transition to get us to this point. And then they give us a Dutch angle, so we're still not settled. And then we have five different endings. So, they still not drag out. I think that's a rough descriptor of how many endings we have from Peter Jackson, but we do have these transitions towards an ending, but they're very good at making sure we're not completely settled with quite a few of them. So there is a real downward fall.
I guess one of the things that I would say, and as you say, you can't exactly say they can't do or they must do or something like that. I think that this could sound needlessly inflammatory, and I don't mean it slightingly. Okay, what I'm thinking is the film version, the visual adaptation, is in a sense more limited. Like the advantage of a visual adaptation is we are more present with it, right? You almost, you're taking it in visually, you're right there with it. There's a kind of an immediacy to it that a book does not have, because then you have to do the work yourself. You have to imagine it in your own head, right? Instead of just seeing it presented in front of you. And there are advantages and disadvantages that come with this, right? The advantage, again, for film, the advantage for visual medium is that immediacy. Things can be presented straight to you without asking, just having to ask you to imagine it, right? But the downside is that you've sort of backed yourself up in a place where you almost need that prop now. To take the leap to say, actually, I've been presenting this stuff to you, but I'm just going to ask you to imagine this, right? I'm not going to show you. I'm just going to ask you to imagine, to fill in that gap yourself, right? That's what Tolkien does in the text. And if we go back for a second and look at how he did it, we see he, we hear out of the depths came his last wail, precious, and he was gone. So Gollum is gone. There was a roar and a great confusion of noise. Fires leaped up and licked the roof. The throbbing grew to a great tumult, and the mountain shook. So all of these things are clear evidence something definitely happened, right? A thing has occurred. These are all effects
Reactions.
that have been caused by a thing, right? But we haven't been shown, we've been invited to just imagine the thing. We're not shown the thing, Right? Sam ran to Frodo and picked him up and carried him out of the door, and there upon the dark threshold of the Samothnaur, high above the plains of Mordor, such wonder and terror came on him that he stood still, forgetting all else, and gazed as one turned to stone. So we get the physical things that happen, the sounds and the sights that he sees, not the sight of the ring being dissolved. We don't see that, right? But or of Gollum being killed. But we get the sounds of how the mountain itself reacts. And then we are then Sam's feeling is described. The wonder and terror that comes upon him. And that's to set us up to imagine what he's going to describe next, which is the great effect of the thing that happened, right? It's all the description, all the things that are described are all the effects of the thing. The thing isn't described. The effects of the thing are described, right? And we're prepared for the big effect, the vision he has of swirling cloud. And we talked about this passage a good deal last time. What he sees and the towers falling and mountains sliding and all that stuff, right? And we're prepped for that by being told how the thing that I'm about to describe to you made him feel, right? The wonder and the terror. All of this is just describing effects. He never describes the event. He just describes the effects of the event, right? But he can do that because, so he's assisting our imagination by like, what does he see? What does he hear? What does it feel like to be there, right? And that helps us to, and then like, what is this vision that he gets? Is he actually seeing it? Is it a spiritual vision? We don't really know, right? He's really vague about that. And he gives it to us in multiple senses, the sounds, even the smell and the feels in some places. But he doesn't show us the thing, right? Whereas in the film, okay, I don't want to say have to again. We do get shown the thing, right? Gollum and then the ring actually hitting and then the moment of the ring dissolving, right? We see the actual ring dissolving. And it feels to me almost like a limitation of the medium, right? Like having shown us these things, like that's what it does is visually, like the visual storytelling would be incomplete in not showing us the thing and only showing us the effects in ways that that verbal storytelling is not, because it's throughout what it does is invite us to imagine things, prompt us to imagine things ourselves. And so prompting us to imagine the ring falling into the fire and melting is a thing it can do. It doesn't even have to tell us that it happened. It just, yeah. Anyway.
And this is another space where I think we could probably play around with the idea and topic of audience reception theory of like, for me, I love looking in scenes like this. I love looking at space and how they use timings of shots and space. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure I've said it before, most shots are 3 to 6 seconds, and it's really annoying, but really fun if you start counting how long shots are. Mm-hmm. And when they hold longer on a certain thing, it's because you're supposed to notice something. So when they hold a shot, and I haven't counted it, but I would imagine this shot is more than 6 seconds, or at least around the 6 second mark of the ring melting, that it would be a still, long, steady shot. That pacing is super effective to me as a viewer personally, and something that would, I think, counter to the pace and the freneticness that we had beforehand. So the impact is huge. Tolkien does the same thing. His text, I mean, you can certainly talk about the meter and the pacing of mm-hmm. his text, but it builds and it builds, and the rhythm that he gets into is, it feels frenetic at times. So yes. By the time the ring goes in, we don't need the descriptor, because it going in is our deep breath. Mm-hmm. It is our moment to sit with it. So you're accomplishing a similar result just through different ways of doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. With Tolkien a lot, with Tolkien's writing a lot, it's about the cadences as well. He stepped too far, toppled, wavered for a moment on the brink, and then with a shriek he fell. Is like the Nazgul came, shooting like flaming bolts, as caught in the fiery ruin of hill and sky, they crackled, withered, and went out. It's a very, very similar cadence, those two sentences, right?
Yeah, and there was a bit, sorry, can you go back through the book? And there was a back forth moment where Gollum was to and fro he swayed. Now, oh no, go back.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm back
That's
now.
right. To and fro he swayed, now so near to the brink that he almost tumbled in, now dragging back, falling to the ground, rising and falling. There's so much movement in there. To, fro, near, almost, tumbled in, dragging back, falling, rising, falling. That's so much movement. Take that into a camera shot. You've just described the fight. So we're getting the same effect just through different modes of story. Sorry, I just grabbed that and was like, oh, that's a really good example
It is a really good
of visual
example.
language being filmic.
Exactly. And the film, and yet, interestingly, the film actually, in a sense, shows less than that, right? At least, especially in the way that it cuts it, right? From like the wrestling with invisible Frodo to visible but shadowy Frodo and Gollum wrestling again. You know, there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, but it's played out differently, and gives a kind of different trajectory, therefore, to Frodo's character. More of a trajectory to Frodo's character, really. Anyway, lots of really fun instances here. But again, I think we can begin to see, again, we can begin to understand a little bit better how the visual storytelling and book storytelling works. And we can see, even though there are some significant differences in how they're doing it, those differences really do seem to me primarily a matter of translation, and really do show some of the things that are different. Well, we're way late now. We should totally let people go. And I'm going to get in
Absolutely.
trouble if I don't go here pretty soon.
I just got a text saying, are you guys still going?
Yeah,
Yes, I'm still
sorry. Yeah, exactly. I'm
going.
just doing the same thing. All right, we should stop. We should stop sooner or later here. We have other passages, other Tolkien passages we want to look at, both in the text and film. There are some, we can do this with some other things. We'd like to go back and revisit, do a similar kind of comparison, perhaps with one of the Jane Austen adaptations
I was
that we
just going
were
to say,
talking
this would be
about
great with
before.
Jane
That
Austen.
be really fun. Anyway, again, just to continue to be looking at how filmic storytelling and book storytelling works and how they're similar and different. But in the meantime, before we do more of that stuff, we're going to be coming back to our special guest, and we maybe there's some other special guests that I've been talking to that we may be bringing in soon as well, to have some more adaptation discussions. We will be but our next but next week, as I said before, we're going to be talking to Jordan Reynolds of the Long Expected Soundscape, looking at his audio engineering work and his audio adaptations of not just The Lord of the Rings, but of many books. What the process of doing that kind of an audio soundtrack and soundscape adaptation is like. So yet another kind of set of vocabularies to try to understand, a different language than the two languages we were talking about today, to translate into. So, Jordan Reynolds, next time. Look forward to meeting with everybody next week, and we'll see you guys next week. Thanks for joining us.
Bye.
Bye.